Colonel Robbins Reult 16. It sounds as though Landon was something of a favourite. I mean, that must have made life difficult for everybody else.
I wouldn't put it like that. Landon was a favourite. They were very good friends from very early on, as I recall from Sandhurst. He was a very loyal officer to the Sultan, and he had his ear. It soon became apparent that he who did not have Landon's ear often was put at a disadvantage. It was a very strange situation, and my boss did not have Landon's ear. They apparently weren't friends, and he didn't see as much of the Sultan as he ought to have done in the job he was holding. It was a desperate and not at all workable situation.
What sort of a chap was the Sultan when you met him? I imagine he was sort of cushioned in his palace.
The Sultan was a very, very nice man. He was always courteous. He was neat, polite, and very fond of the British. However, he kept certain people at arm's length. Browning was one. I only saw the Sultan myself alone once or twice in that whole 3 years I was there, although I was at all the big conferences.
What was your day-to-day working life like then?
Very hard. I had a lot of administration to do, and I used to get up early, go down to my office, where I ran one department of personnel, one department of administration, one department of trade, and generally ran the whole thing. At the head of each department, I had a British officer, and then we were training Arabs to take over from us. We worked from about 7 a.m. till lunchtime, and then people went to the beach or rested. I usually used to rest. I didn't like going out in the sun too much. And I always used to go back to work from 5 o'clock in the evening till about 8, when I went to have a drink with Browning before dinner, and we always discussed our work. So it was a long day. And Fridays, as it was a Muslim country, was always a holiday. We worked on Saturday and Sunday. I took time off when I wanted, but did not do it a lot. I had leave once a month, every 4 months. Very nice. I used to fly back to England, and I used to do a job or two here on behalf of the Sultan. Then I used to get an allowance of £100 a day, which was a lot of money in those days, being paid to go back on leave. Everything was free. I was very, very well off financially. I used to have a month's good leave here in England, and then go back, first class, and back to the grind. When I was in India, when I was in Muscat, because India is quite close, I used to fly to India to, on behalf of the ministry, to buy weapons and food and so on. I used to take an advisor or two. I used to live in the Taj Hotel, the best hotel in India and in the world, some said. I had a suite and was very well looked after, and used to see the important Indians who we dealt with. One of the Sultan's agents was a man called Kimji Ramdas, whose father had been the old Sultan's agent. And this boy was now the young Sultan's agent. I was very friendly with him, and he looked after me in India very well. While I was in India staying at the Taj, I made the opportunity not only of seeing the Omani ambassador there doing our own business, but also ensuring that I saw the yoga people who I had kept in touch with. And that was a very rewarding time for me. I did this on more than one occasion. And because of my job and because of what Oman was, I was able to do it in luxury and take that time off. I can't grumble.
So were the training that the troops were doing, how different was that to the infantry training that you'd
delivered
in Britain?
I didn't really see much of the troops training. I really don't know. I take it they were all right. I visited one or two battalions, but I never saw any training. And of course, they'd all been in action against the communists. I suppose they were all right.
How did you get on with the Omanis as a race?
They're very nice people, the Omanis, always courteous and very helpful. I liked them. I liked them. Like all Arabs, they had, a lot of them were very idle, and you had to spur them on to do their job. And always we were spurring them on to take over from the British. And and that was not just in the administration of the country, but in the forces as well. And while I was there, we advanced quite a way towards being able to do this. But they are a very nice race, the Omanis. Many of them, of course, hailed from Zanzibar. There was a mixture of that, because Oman, in the old days, conquered Zanzibar, and they were great slave traders, the Omanis. And they brought back many Zanzibarian women and married into them, and therefore there's this Afro strain which runs through a certain part of them. But they are an Arab race. And a different race from, say, the Saudis, who are bang next door.
How did you get on with the seconded British officers?
I had many friends who were seconded, and I in our social life and whenever we met, I was always very friendly with them because, after all, they were soldiers and I'd been a soldier. It came naturally to be very friendly with them. It was with the staff and the commanders, senior commanders, that we had our troubles. That was a different story.
Did you see yourself as staying there for a long time? Or?
I did not see myself staying there for a long time. My contract was 3 years, and I really didn't know whether if I were offered another 1 year or 2 years, whether I would take it. It depended on A, how much I could stand, and B, what my financial situation was. But it didn't arise. In fact, at the end of 3 years, Browning's contract was up, and he went to say goodbye to the Sultan. And the Sultan said, "I think you have done very well." And Browning said, "Yes, when I came here, your Ministry of Defense was 65 million rials in debt. Now, after 3 years, I have to report to you, Your Majesty, that we are 90 million rials in credit, and that is entirely due to the work that we've been able to do for you." "Well done," said the Sultan. "What can I do for you? What would you like?" And Browning wasn't a very greedy man. He said, "Well, I've saved that amount of money for you. Maybe you'd like to give me, 1%. Whatever it was, it amounted to £1 million or £2. And Brownie was very decent. He said, Colonel Robbins has helped me. I'd like to give him a tenth of what I get. Certainly anything you like, said the Sultan. And that was the end of Browning's 3 years. When he came back to his office, this had leaked out from Landon or whoever. And Browning was told by the cabal, the treasury, the senior, that he should never have asked for money, which was very strange, because they all did. Anyway, this was right at the end, and Browning said to me, I'm going to take a week's leave. The Sultan has lent me his aeroplane, and I'm going to fly to India. And you will look after the place while I'm away, as I always did. And he went away. And I said, please don't go away until that million is in your bank. Nonsense, he said, I trust him. I trust them. He went. The minute he'd gone, I was assaulted by the cabal and was told that that Browning would be very lucky when he came back not to be in prison for doing whatever it was. I didn't know what he'd done. And so would I. Very strange state of affairs. And a very difficult week for me. A week passed, and at midnight on one night, I met the plane, Sultan's plane, with Browning and his wife coming back from India. Out he came, smiling. I've had a lovely time, and how does it feel, Jim, to be a rich man? I said, I should take the smile off your face, because you are not a rich man. And I'm told we are both likely to be in prison tomorrow morning. This was a bit of a shattering blow for him. And we went back. Sure enough, the money had not been paid, and he was summoned and told by the Sultan that he was to leave that week. No money. How all this happened, I do not know, but it was clearly through Landon and the cabal who were against him. So Browning left without any money.
Extraordinary.
Before he left, he said, I'm going to write a book exposing what has happened here. This frightened everybody. And he was then paid a certain amount of money. I don't know how much, not that. But I never got anything out of that. And he didn't. He got a bit, I suppose. Enough to buy himself a place in Greece and a big house. And before he left, he said to the Arab who took over from him, who was not a friend of mine, I hope you will look after Colonel Robbins and let it for the rest of his contract. Absolutely, said this Arab, I will look after him as if he were my brother. Within 3 weeks, I was given my marching orders. That's how well he kept his word. And in this strange setup, there was an RAF officer who wanted my job, and he'd been planning and plotting with the new Arab. All this was going on, and I could do nothing. In our setup, there was one Brigadier Thwaites, an ex-grenadier, who had been a great friend of... He was chief of staff, really, and he'd been a great friend of Browning's and mine. And he did all he could to help. In the end, I went.
What were your feelings on leaving?
My feelings were relief and satisfaction at having made enough money. Relief that I'd finished this ghastly place. Disappointment that I had not paid my full amount that had been promised, several thousands. And I went. When I got back to England, the Sultan's agent here, a certain Mr. Kendall, a friend of mine, said, The Sultan is visiting the Prime Minister Meg and Maggie Thatcher and the Queen. There is this matter of your underpayment. Would you like it? I said, yes, I wrote a letter. And he said, I'll see the Sultan gets this. Unfortunately, my letter, in which I said, I'm owed so much money, Your Majesty, nothing to do with you, but may I have it, that sort of letter. It reached the Sultan, the Sultanate's embassy in London, whereas it were one of these, Landon was friends was running it and so on. They saw this letter from me to the Sultan, tore it open and tore it up. And told me they'd done it. Well, I said to the agent here, this has happened. He said, write it again, I will deliver it personally. I wrote this letter saying how many thousands I was owed. It was delivered by hand next day to the Sultan, and the following day a cheque arrived on this desk, which I'm sitting at, of the full amount. Sultan was an honest man. It is those who were against us and in between who were the villains in this piece. So really that was the end. I always kept in touch with Brigadier Thwaites. We used to lunch together every 5 or 6 weeks. Unfortunately, he died of kidney disease. A great friend. I had one or two great friends from Oman. One was in the Blues and Royals, who I used to climb the mountains with. Another was my sort of ADCMA. Another was Thwaites. I had many good friends there, including one or two good Arab friends, sheikhs, who visited me here in my house in Wiltshire and said to me, is there anything more we can do for you, Colonel? Would you like a swimming pool here? Would you? I am not the sort of man who can easily say, I suppose if I'd had my head screwed on, I'd have said, yes, I would like an indoor swimming pool. Or I would like a large garage built on here. Or I would like this and that. I did absolutely nothing. They were astonished. They frequently left me substantial gifts. Very difficult to know what to do with them, but that was that. One man who visited me here was the Indian Ajit, to turn up in his Rolls Royce. I knew his family well. He used to turn up. Another was the Yemeni Sheikh, who was on our Ahmed, Sheikh Ahmed. Another was Sheikh Bawan, who owned the great motor works there, who, unbeknown to me, sent me a car. Those were the sort of things they did. So I had many friends, but of course many enemies. And I'm told we escaped assassination on more than one occasion.
Brilliant, yeah. It seems that the Arabs have a sort of, it seems to me, listening to this, a strange way of involving money in all relationships or...
Oh, yes, I agree.
They got so much of it.
These particular Arabs we were dealing with were very rich men through the oil. And I helped them in certain contracts. And again, you see, if I were an unscrupulous man, I could have said, as I've helped you with this contract, wouldn't 5% be fair to give me in my bank and no one need know about it? But the agreement that Browning and I had was that if any of us were ever bribed or bribes were offered, each would tell the other, and that we did. So I never accepted any of that. And I would be a very wealthy man now if I had accepted these matters, because they were contracts of millions and millions of pounds. There you are. One is made the way one is. And I do not regret it. I would not like to have on my conscience that I had behaved in an underhand way. I thank the good Lord. for the fortunate life I've had, both in the army and thereafter. When I came here, I had enough money to buy this house we're in. It was derelict. My sons had telephoned me in Oman and had sent me photos, and I said, I don't like the look of it. Oh, Dad, it's going on auction. How much will it go for? I said, oh, maybe £40,000. We've got 8 acres. I should buy it. I said, no, I don't like it. Can we go to the auction? Yes. And if you bid, don't go a penny over 38. They rang me that night in Oman. Dad, sit down. I said, you haven't done it? Yes. What have you done? We've bought it. What? How much? They said, I said, have you gone over 40, 50? What have you done? They said, we got it for 25. Of course, I had to spend two or three times that on renovating because it was derelict. Mm. But that's the sort of money one was able to earn. And that was why I went out to the Oman.
Yeah. And did you ever resent the fact that it sounds as though the Omani, the Sultan, you know, knew he could buy anything he wanted?
Did I feel any resentment? I have never felt resentment about it. Mm. God wills that they can do it, and that's that. Mm. It's the will of God.
And the relationship between the British government and the British military seconded out there, you said that was kept pretty secret.
It was always kept secret from the public in Britain that we had British officers fighting against the communists for the Arabs in Oman. Never was it ever published, and never were we allowed to speak about it.
So when you left Oman, that was your end of your military career?
That was the end of my military career, and I did not want another job. And in 1979, I married my present wife, who you have met, and that's 24 years ago. I had by then been a widower for 17 years. So life has gone on. And I have lived in Wiltshire, where I am now the chairman of the Old Comrades, and I have played a part on the Conservative Association here as an officer. And I have done many lectures and so on, and I have many reunions and meetings. I enjoy very much going once a month to my club in London, the Army and Navy, where we have a luncheon club of people from different regiments and services who have known each other for maybe 40 years. Keeps one going, and although I don't like London, I like going to London once a month for that purpose.
Do you have contact with the Army today, the TA or the...
Oh, yes, I have continual contacts with the TA, and I visit them, the Wiltshire TA, and I am on certain committees, and I keep in touch at my regimental headquarters and association, and I run organisations and reunions, so I have a fairly full life.
What impression do you get of the way the regiment is organised now compared to how it was when you were involved in it?
Well, it's a very different world. When I was involved, each regiment had its own two battalions. Each regiment had its own band. When I was in India, my band and drums was about 80 or 90 strong. Now we've got a band which has to cater for 8 different regiments. We are no longer the Wiltshire Regiment. We, in 1959, we amalgamated with the Royal Berkshires and became the Duke of Edinburgh's Royal Regiment. 30 years later, we were again rubbed out and amalgamated with the Gloucesters. We are now the Royal Gloucester Berkshire Wiltshire Regiment, unkindly known as the M4 Regiment by some in the Army. And so it goes on. But the regiment is doing very well. It's only been going, amalgamated, 8 or 9 years. And I keep in touch always.
Do you get any impression of whether people are happier in the regiment now than they were?
It's a different world. What they don't know, what they haven't experienced, they won't know. I mean, I had a wonderful life. Never could this approach, the present-day soldier approach it. There's no such thing as an officer's mess run the way it used to be. All of us had a batman. I don't think there's such a thing as a batman in the British Army now. In a way, it was a coddled life, but on the other hand, as an officer, you had to do more than the men. And there was a very special relationship. I don't know whether that relationship exists or not. It was the men. Three times this year, I have been invited by London University to go to Normandy on a battlefield tour as a veteran and describe to these young people particular battles. I expected a lot of yobs, but no. About 120 came. They were perfectly neat and dressed well and courteous. And it was a great privilege to do it. This week I have been invited again to go next year to do a battlefield tour with London University of the Battle of Arnhem, in which I was with the Wiltshire Regiment.
Why have they chosen you?
Because I am one of the few veterans left. In fact, one of the men introducing me said, "We're very lucky we've got Colonel Robbins. He'll be dead soon," as an introduction. I hope he was...
Wrong.
Well, there we are. But yeah. That is what I do, and it keeps me going. Mm. That and yoga, Lindsay.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.